Yale School of Management enjoyed a year-over-year increase of 12.3% for the class that entered last September. Let's learn about this year's entering class and how you can become a member of next year's entering class. Welcome to the 273rd episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result, you get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Before I dive into today's interview, I want to mention that today's episode is sponsored by Accepted's Guide, 5 Fatal Flaws to Avoid in Your MBA Essays. This free download will help you avoid the most common mistakes that applicants make with their application essays. Download your free copy at accepted.com/273download. Again, that's accepted.com/273download. It gives me great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Admissions Straight Talk, Laurel Grodman, Director of Admissions, Analytics, and Evaluation at Yale School of Management. Laurel is a Yalie through and through. She earned her bachelor's at Yale in 2002 and her MBA from Yale SOM in 2006. After working for Citigroup and Unilever, she returned to Yale as Senior Associate Director for Career Development in 2010. In 2014, she became the Director of Admissions for Analytics and Evaluation. Laurel, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Linda, thanks so much for having me on today.
Delighted. Now, let's start with the very basics. Can you give me a brief overview of the full-time MBA program at Yale, focusing on differentiators?
Sure thing, be happy to. So anytime that I talk about Yale, I think the best place to start is with our mission, which is to educate leaders for business and society. It's the founding mission of the school, and it's really what brings everything together here. Everyone certainly brings their own unique perspective to the mission and their own sense of purpose, but I think it really is the main unifier within our community. So to me, it's always the best place to start. So I think that mission kind of in and of itself is a differentiator for the program and the type of candidates that attracts and the types of roles and career paths that our alumni take. But in thinking a little bit more concretely about some of the differentiators, I think they all go back to the mission in one way, shape, or form. But there's three things I'll highlight. The first being our objective to be the business school that's most integrated with its home university. So being a part of SOM, you really are part of Yale University more broadly, and you get a lot of access there. Most concretely, I think about the access to classes across the entire university. So our students can take their electives in any number, in any classroom throughout the entire school. So I think that that's really, really neat. And we certainly encourage our students to take advantage of that and get a more cross-disciplinary view within their management education. The second differentiator I'll highlight is our objective to be the business, to be the most distinctively global U.S. business school. So we have a global studies requirement. So every student will experience at least one opportunity to engage globally while they're here. But in fact, most do much more than that. And that's really fueled by our membership in the Global Network for Advanced Management, which is a network we established 6 years ago, brings together 30 different business schools across the globe, and a lot of our global travel options, a lot of our global study options are really fueled by that network. So I think that's a really great feature that we're able to take advantage of as well. And the third thing I'll point to that is really quite distinctive is our integrated curriculum. So at Yale SOM, we absolutely teach the business fundamentals. We teach them well. You'll learn about markets and competition and building teams and organization. But beyond that, we kind of go a step further in showing you how that all works together. So instead of your traditional kind of core MBA curriculum, which is organized around how basically academic departments look, operations, finance, mm-hmm. accounting, marketing, so on, instead we organize our core around what we call the organizational perspective. So it's all the different stakeholders that that have stake within an organization. So it could be the investor or the customer or the innovator. And each of those courses is we'll integrate the ideas that you'd find in traditional academic departments and discipline, but it's much more pointed in showing you how they work together. And so sometimes that looks like co-teaching with faculty members from across departments. Sometimes it brings in kind of thought experts from across the entire university because the necessary knowledge may not be housed within a management school. So again, it's a much more integrative approach. So those are the things that really stand out to me as the differentiators within our program.
In terms of the integrated curriculum, mm-hmm. does it carry through? I mean, I understand that it's part of the core, but does it mm-hmm. carry through as people become more advanced?
That's a good question. I think in a more subtle way, and I think it ties into that ability to take electives throughout the entire right. university or any kind of a series of electives here. So we don't have distinctive kind of majors or concentrations. And the idea is that it is up to you to decide what will create kind of that integrated curriculum continuation within your electives. And that's not going to look the same for any two people. So that encouragement to continue to integrate perspectives, whether it's across SOM or across Yale, is still there, but it's not explicitly prescribed the way that it would be within the core.
Okay. And is there any, this just popped into my head. I mean, you mentioned mm-hmm. that, you know, traditional curriculums are organized almost like traditional schools are organized, which is basically mm-hmm. by business function. Is there any right. thought to try and organize the departments or the faculty by the perspectives? I'm just curious.
I wouldn't necessarily have insight into that.
You know that. Okay, fair enough.
No, I mean, I think there are other institutional reasons to have academia organized right. that way. But in terms mm-hmm. of the way that's presented to the student, the real idea behind this is when you're presented with business challenges in the real world, they're not organized by problem type in that way. Right. You just have big, messy problems, and it requires you to pull from a lot of different knowledge areas. So it's much easier, I think, to reorganize the way that information is presented to the students than to wholesale change the way academia is structured. But who knows?
Yeah. Okay.
It's an interesting question for sure.
Yeah. What's new at Yale SOM?
Yeah, so a couple of things that come to mind there. So we've within the past year kind of continued our streak of strong new faculty hires. So we have some recent additions to finance and operations and marketing and economics department, including a new faculty director for our program on social enterprise. So we're always happy to bring new talent into the organization. And this is really building off of a few years of incredibly strong faculty hires. We've had a number of really incredible additions to our finance department coming predominantly from Chicago, probably most notably Toby Moskowitz. So it's great to see kind of the continued momentum there. That's one thing that comes to mind. We've also continued to build out our master's degree program in addition to our MBA. So we have a master's degree in systemic risk that continues to grow, and that brings in people working at central banks, which is certainly an interesting perspective to have that voice in the classroom as well. We are bringing in our inaugural class of the Master of Management Studies in Global Business and Society, and that's a small but probably growing program targeted towards early career students who have spent time in some of those global network schools that I mentioned. So all of this, I think from an MBA applicant's perspective, just brings additional voices to campus. It deepens our connection to that international network of schools and just brings more, I think, perspectives to the classroom, which is great. So those are two things. And probably one of the biggest things we have going on is we're in the midst of a search for our next dean.
Yeah.
So that's actively underway. And, it's in the earlier stages. Probably more in the information gathering and listening tour aspects as the faculty search committee kind of kicks this off. We're talking a lot about as a school what's important. Obviously keeping the school's momentum going while staying focused on the mission is a top priority there. So I think that will continue to unfold in the coming months.
Right. Okay. Let me add a question about the global network before I move on.
Sure.
Is the global nature of Yale mostly in the form of the global network, the ability to take classes remotely, really, and it was in like 30 schools around the world? Is it something like that?
Or, yeah, the network is 30 strong, yeah.
Yeah. Or And is that global access supplemented by the more traditional, you know, student exchange programs, treks, et cetera?
I think it's both. So, I mean, Yale was certainly a global place to be and a place where students engage globally even before the network was established 6 years ago. I think the network, though, is an important vehicle for expanding the ways in which our students have been able to make those things happen. And so we do. We have exchange programs and, you know, the global network has helped with that as well. There were international experience trips, which were a very kind of popular option for engaging globally here, that predated the network as well. I think the network has made better some of the things that we already had in place, and it's opened up opportunity for new things like, you know, something that couldn't have existed before. We have these really neat things called Global Network Week. So think about twice a year, 700 students will travel to one of, let's say, 17 or so campuses might host one at a given time. And it's an opportunity to learn for a week in that campus's or that region's area of expertise. And you're sitting in a truly global classroom. So you may have one or two other students from Yale there with you, but you're going to have students from across those 30 schools. So it's global on a number of different levels. And that type of opportunity wouldn't have been possible without the global network. But I think this has always been a place where we've had a strong international community, where there's been mindfulness about bringing kind of global examples into the classroom. And I think that's always been in the DNA. The global network has just really strengthened our ability to deliver that.
Okay. What is something really cool that a Yale grad is doing, recent grad?
Yeah. So
could be entrepreneurial.
I'm going to cheat a little bit here because I had trouble thinking about just one. I recently did an admissions reception in London this past summer where we had a good number of alums with us. And frankly, every single one of them was doing something really cool. One thing that got me started thinking in that area was we have a class of 2014 graduate who had just moved to the London office of CNN, where she's the vice president of international operations and strategy at CNN Digital. So there's lots that's cool about that.
Yeah, really.
But what I loved about her was she was someone I had worked with when I was working in the CDO, and her pre-SOM experience had been in a nonprofit setting. And so she was able to make a really, really substantial pivot, of course, applying all of the relevant skills that she had built along the way. But to go from nonprofit, and she was functionally doing something quite different, to, you know, running a major function within CNN Digital, I thought was just really wonderful. But like I said, there were people doing all sorts of amazing things just in this random collection of people who happened to be in the London area and available to come to our event. So there was a graduate from the early 90s there who's super passionate about economic development in urban areas. And he's been doing a ton of kind of investment director work across public-private partnerships, which is a term that has been coming up a lot in just reading about our applicants' interest in the last year or two. So I thought that was interesting. We had a treasury manager who's at a very cool kind of peer-to-peer lending company. There was an AVP at CCS Fundraising, which consults to nonprofits. There were people who had, you know, been doing very traditional banking roles for the past 15 years, someone from a gaming company. So in this very random sampling, I thought it was a very SOM group in that people were doing pretty much anything that you can imagine in any industry and any sector. And for some of the alums who had been out further, you know, even within a career, had kind of trod many different areas.
Okay. I think we've given people good reason to be interested in Yale SOM. let's turn to the application and start discussing how they can actually get accepted. Now, I sometimes find that applicants look at MBA applications and they don't see them. Frankly, we're talking about a lot of integration in terms of Yale's curriculum. I don't think they see it as an integrated whole. They see them, the different elements, as almost random. So I'd like to go through the elements in Yale's application. And I know that the admissions office put them together very strategically and purposefully. I'd like to go through the different elements in Yale's application and discuss the role of each one, the purpose of each one. Let's start with a resume.
Sure. Yeah. What may even help just at a high level is because I think all of these elements, and we can certainly touch upon the individual application elements, but they all feed into a fairly straightforward kind of higher framework that we're thinking about.
Okay.
And so maybe it'll help for me to kind of outline that. And then as we talk about the elements, I can talk about where each of these play in, because some of them will play into multiple things, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. Please go ahead.
Great. So it's a, you know, we're really at the highest level looking for three things. We're looking for people who are academically prepared, who have demonstrated impact in their professional settings or, you know, outside of their professional settings, so we can gauge your potential as a leader and a collaborator. And we're looking for engaged community members. And so as we think about the application, I think everything that we ask for feeds into one or more of those areas, and they work in tandem. So, you know, we're not weighting them all equally, I guess,
really?
For every single candidate. It's if we get more information from one piece of your application, we may need a little bit less from somewhere else. And maybe as we go through some of the examples, I can talk about this some more. But really, at a high level, it's pretty straightforward. Those are the things that we're looking for. And then we'll use each of the elements to get at them. So, you know, thinking about the resume, I mean, that's probably most directly related to that piece around impact in your professional settings and elsewhere. So we're looking to understand your career trajectory, the transitions that you've made, and most specifically, really, the impact that you've had on the teams and the organizations that you've been at each step along the way. So those bullet points are really important in that respect. It's not just about listing your job responsibilities. It's about telling us what kind of a difference you made in the opportunities you've had to make that difference, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I mean, I'm constantly advising applicants to focus on results.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it also, I think, tells us a little bit about that engagement piece as well, because obviously the resume isn't just limited to your professional experiences. You can be talking about even within the professional realm, how you've engaged in your professional community. People do lots of exciting things outside of work. It's an opportunity to tell us about all of that.
And on some level, your work is your community. I mean, we're all members of multiple communities.
Right. Of course.
One of our communities is our work. So.
Yes, for sure.
All right. All right. So that's the resume. What about Yale's single essay?
Yep. So we ask our applicants to describe the biggest commitment they've ever made. Mm-hmm. And that, too, has, especially depending on the topic that you go with, has the potential to tell us about a number of different aspects of your application, depending on where you decide to take it. But what we're really looking for there is an understanding of how you approach the thing that is most important to you, which gives us, you know, a sense of how you approach important things more generally. I get a lot of questions around what's the right topic to write around, and there really isn't one. We've seen great essays coming from a lot of different areas, personal, professional. It can be something broad or specific, but what really we're looking for is that approach to whatever that commitment is. We want to understand how you take on big things in your life and carry through on them. And so that's really what we're looking for there.
Is it appropriate to explain why you made this particular big commitment, or why you consider it your biggest commitment?
Sure. And that tends to usually pretty organically come out with it. And that's mm-hmm. sort of a ringing endorsement for why you should be genuine in this, because you're not going to be able to kind of answer that in a useful way unless this really is something that is truly meaningful to you.
Okay. And how does the video component fit into the framework that you outlined?
The video questions are probably the area of the application that create kind of the most anxiety in our applicants, or at least anecdotally, that's what I hear. And I think it never ends up being as kind of angst-ridden as people are anticipating. But the video questions help us do a couple of different things. At most basic level, they give us a quasi kind of face-to-face interaction before the point where you'd be invited into interview. It gives us a sense of how you think on your feet, which is an important skill to have, certainly in the MBA classroom, but arguably in life itself. So it gives mm-hmm. us a little bit more sense of spontaneous speaking. For are candidates for whom English is not a first language. It gives us an ability to assess that and has allowed us to eliminate any kind of English language testing requirements. So we don't require the TOEFL or anything like that. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of success just using the video questions to do that. And then more targetedly, we do ask specific things within the questions that help us get a better understanding of some of the points that I was talking about earlier in terms of your leadership potential and how you would react in different scenarios. Again, it's nothing meant to trick you. It's not cases or riddles or anything like that. It's what you would prepare for a typical kind of MBA interview. But it adds a little bit more dimension, I think, to an application that otherwise we're just reading on paper.
Okay, great. How do the recommendations fit in? You have two professional recommendations, right?
Yep. And those, I think, again, most directly lead into the impact piece of it in a professional setting and letting us understand a little bit better your potential as a leader. And that is, exactly what we're able to get from it. Depends a little bit on what the recommender gives us. But that's why we're asking ideally for a someone who either is your current supervisor or ideally has supervised you recently, because it should really be someone who knows you in and out, who's interacted with you on a, hopefully daily or close to daily basis, and can really speak to your strengths and let us know, in very concrete ways how you've contributed to the teams and the organizations that you've been a part of. So, when thinking about the two professional recommendations, I always recommend that applicants think about how, two people that they've had those levels of interaction with complement each other. Are there two people who can maybe highlight two different areas of strengths or different aspects of the kinds of work that you've done? And so it's important to think about how the two play together and what's going to give us the most well-rounded view of what you bring to the table.
I think the key word you used was complement each other.
Yes.
Yeah. And lastly, but certainly not least, is mm-hmm. the interview.
Yep.
What is the purpose behind that?
Yeah. So the interview, the way it works at Yale is it's by invitation. So not everyone will be interviewed, though everyone who's offered admission will ultimately have had an interview. It gives us an opportunity to continue to tease out some of the information about your work experience and the contributions that you've made, and then allows us to get a little bit more into your goals and why you want to come to business school. And again, gives us something beyond the two dimensions that we get on paper and an opportunity to actually interact with a candidate. It also gives the interviewee an important opportunity to learn more about us and about our community. So the majority of our interviews are conducted by second-year students. My staff conducts interviews as well, particularly when we do them in hub locations, but we really try to pair up as many applicants as possible with students, because that's yet another vantage point into the school and an opportunity for you to engage with a community member during the time you're here. So I honestly think of it as a two-way interview. And it's an important chance for applicants to get a deeper sense of us and who we are. And we ideally have our candidates come to campus if they can to interview, and we put together a full day around that. So it really is, it's an opportunity for us to get a little bit more information, but it's a big opportunity, I think, for the applicant to get more information from us in the sense of, whether this is the right place for them.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Now,
sure.
Last year, this, I think that was just a great overview. So,
great.
All right. Yeah. Last year, Yale enjoyed a 12% increase in its application volume. And by that, I mean the class that entered in 2017.
Right.
How was application volume for this year's entering class?
Yes. Which we're our entering class, which starts on Monday. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of interest in the stats for the incoming class. So we've been so fortunate to see such dramatic and kind of sustained application growth really over the past 5 years. That number that you said, that 12% increase, really represents a 60% increase versus where we had been 5 years prior, which
That's
is
fantastic.
Incredible.
Yeah.
But as we knew, to some extent, and it being kind of counter trend, it wasn't entirely sustainable. So we did see a bit of a dip this year, nothing concerning. It was still our second highest volume that we've seen, which was something to celebrate. But, I'd consider it a pretty natural fluctuation in the scheme of things.
Right. And also, I think a lot of schools are experiencing that.
Yes, no, I don't think that this was kind of counter trend in any way. If anything, I think our kind of exponential growth was, and we were happy to ride that while we could. But I think we continue to be in a good place. It was still a very strong application year, and so we were certainly grateful for that.
Were international applications hit more than domestic?
Yeah, a little bit.
Down more.
Yeah, a little. And I'm always hesitant to make any kind of sweeping judgments based on 1 year as a data point. I mean, it's certainly something we'll continue to look at. And it wasn't something so incredibly dramatic as to cause panic or anything. But yeah, the decline was a little steeper for international students versus domestic. And, you know, you can hypothesize any number of reasons for that.
Yeah, well, again, I think most schools are, most certainly U.S. schools, let's put it that way, are experiencing that dip. Are students having more trouble getting visas once they are, if they do apply and are accepted, are they having more trouble getting visas to come into the country?
It's a good question. There are a small number of visa challenges every summer for a variety of reasons. And so I'm not sure if what we experienced this year was outside of the range of normal. It certainly wasn't to the level where it was concerning as far as thinking about, admissions going forward. It seemed to me to be in the realm of regular, but it's certainly something we're continuing to keep an eye on. If anything, I think maybe the concern around this is having more upstream effects. So I think there might be, that certainly could be one contributing factor to deterring international
applicants. Meaning that getting jobs will be more difficult.
It could be, or even, there could even be sort of be concern about, will I have trouble getting a visa to even attend school? It's hard to say for sure. One thing, again, this is very anecdotally, so I don't know that this is so outside the realm of where we'd normally see it, but I had heard, in a few instances, folks who had been admitted tipping towards staying in a current role if they were on an H-1B visa in the U.S. versus foregoing that visa and going to school. So that's kind of a decision point that, I imagine people were making in any given year, but it was just a little bit more salient this year.
Right. Makes sense. Okay. Now, for the class of 2019, in other words, last year's entering class, to my knowledge, the class profile is not yet posted for the class that's going to start on Monday, because you probably still are juggling a couple waitlisted people, right?
We have to definitely lock the class when the class starts. So we will we'll definitely within the next couple of weeks.
You have 2 days, I think, right? Three days, 3 working days, right?
Okay. Yes.
But for the class of 2019, the middle 80th percent GMAT range was 690 to 760, and the middle 80th percent GPA range was 3.38 to 3.94. The averages were 730 for the GMAT, 330 for the GRE, and 3.69 for the undergrad GPA. What do you look for besides stats, and how does one get into Yale SOM with below average stats?
Okay. All good questions, and those updated stats will be posted, because I know people find those helpful as a starting point in thinking about what schools to apply to. Am I at least in range, or if I'm not in range, what do I need to be thinking about to have this be a viable application? So that is definitely a fair question. So obviously we look at lots besides stats. So all of the components of the application that we talked about before really didn't touch upon the academic
preparation. That's right. Exactly.
And so we are looking at a lot else. I think it's probably important to start by saying we don't have cutoffs. So while those are the ranges that are calculated based on who actually comes in, it's not as though we're taking those and then saying, okay, anyone below that, we're not looking at by any means.
Going back to your three-part framework, these are the ones that relate directly to academic preparedness. Everything else we discuss doesn't really relate to that.
That's right. So, it's important to keep in mind, we're looking at all of those in tandem. And so we want to bring people into the program who are going to be able to succeed and thrive here. So we don't want to set people up for failure. So we do care about your academic preparation, because it's the best indicator we have about how you will fare once you're here. But that said, of people with a range of levels of preparation do come here and succeed here. So that's sort of, I would say, my starting point in thinking about this. Take the ranges with, as advisory, but take it also, knowing that there are many components to the application, which we already spoke about, and this is one piece of it. So specifically thinking about how to get in with below average stats. So again, average is purely that, isn't an average. Half of the class exactly. is coming in with a number before that or below right. that. Right. But also, you know, the first step I think is identifying and being aware of where the weaknesses lie, and then not being afraid of thinking about ways to counter that, either by taking actions or by giving us kind of more information. So I can talk a little bit more about each of those. So
please.
So a few of these things work in tandem. So I think about GPA and GMAT as kind of parts of a whole, and again, not taken in equal measure for every candidate. So if your undergraduate performance was lower, we are going to, you know, need to place more weight on your more recent evidence of academic preparation, which would be your testing. So if you had lower undergraduate performance, show us how focused you are now on really being, you know, ready to prepare for that GMAT or GRE, and give us that confidence in that more recent data point that you are going to be academically prepared here. You can think about whether supplemental coursework makes sense. You know, a common example we get is people who are concerned that they don't have a lot of undergraduate exposure to quant concepts. Maybe their testing isn't exactly where they want to be. That might be a good time to think about whether taking some microeconomics or statistics courses might make sense to, again, demonstrate now at this point in time, I'm able to do this work. So I think, you know, kind of being aware and then thinking of ways to counter it. Obviously, shining in other areas helps. So if you are below these ranges, it will be helpful to be sort of above range, if you will, in some of the other areas. So someone who has just really demonstrated above and beyond professional impact is going to, we're going to have, I think, an easier time looking at all of this as a whole, even if it includes some lower range on the stats than someone who has, you know, is not necessarily above the norm in any particular area, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Another thing I'll mention is, you know, give us context if it's relevant to why your stats may have been not where you wanted them to be. You know, and this isn't going to be relevant to everyone, but we understand people go through challenges at different parts in their life, and people have, you know, things going on during their undergraduate education that may not come to the surface and over the course of the application naturally, but there's an opportunity to address that. We do have an optional statement. By all means, not everyone needs to use it, but use it if it's relevant and use it if it is going to give the committee a little bit more context around, you know, how those stats were achieved. Those are the things that come to mind there.
Great. I would think context would be more relevant in the case of a below average GPA, assuming there was some context, than let's say a GMAT.
That's right.
Because you can always retake the GMAT or the GRE.
It is true, although I will say that context can be helpful. I think of one specific scenario that does come up once in a while. Oftentimes, our military candidates are deployed or on a submarine or somewhere where this is literally less possible. So it's never. But you're right. Undergraduate, education tends to be the more, the place where context does become a little bit more relevant.
Right. I think I mean, I'm in Southern California, so earthquakes are always a factor. And every so often,
absolutely. It's always something exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Something like that. All right. What are the most common mistakes that you feel applicants make when applying to Yale SOM?
I think, you know, the one that is sort of the most uncomfortable to read, in a sense, is an applicant who's not being genuine. So by that, I mean kind of presenting a version of themselves that they think we want to hear based on what they know about SOM in our community.
And how does it manifest itself?
Yeah, so it's fine. It's good, obviously, to do research on a school, and it's good to answer questions, again, authentically, to who you are and what you're bringing to the table with knowledge of what is valued by the school and community that you're targeting. But it's also it's not good to force that where it doesn't exist. So making up career interests, for instance, that one maybe thinks sound like something that Yale SOM admissions committee would be interested in, when it really doesn't tie into anything that you've done or anything else that you've talked about within the application. That's one that comes to mind. Obviously, Yale SOM has a strong nonprofit heritage, but we also have, you know, graduates who are in every realm of nonprofit, for-profit, and government work, and overwhelmingly in the private sector. So sort of force-fitting something based on an old impression of the school. Again, this kind of, it becomes very clear when you're seeing it. So, and it's also, frankly, it's hard to maintain a facade like that across an entire application process. It's just much easier to be yourself and to be true to your own background and your own interests than to have to pretend to be someone that you think we want to know about. So that's one thing that comes to mind. Another one is, I think this manifests in a few ways, is not leaving enough time for the process. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to say this. I know in practice, applicants are juggling a lot of different things, but like anything in life, this is that is important to you. You need to plan for it. And it becomes very clear when someone has rushed together an application at the last moment. One manifestation of this is you've just force fit another school's essay into ours. We do ask something pretty distinct. And it becomes pretty obvious when you've written an essay for another school with a different question and just sort of tweaked it here and there. And to me, that usually... I'm assuming that usually it's coming down to timing, and you just haven't left enough time to give yourself to answer our specific question here. Careless errors come out, I think, also from not leaving enough time for the process. I mean, don't get me wrong. It keeps committee fun when someone misspells their major or even their own name, but it doesn't do the applicant any favors, obviously, in demonstrating how seriously they're taking an important task. So that's why we care about things like, spelling mistakes and things like that, because this is, we're kind of taking as a given that this is an important process for you. And so we want to see that you're approaching it the way that you would approach anything that's important to you, any important commitment that you're making. So those are sort of maybe a nitty grittier level. I'd say another mistake that's maybe a little less easy to define is just applicants who aren't trusting the process. Obviously, our school, I'm sure every school, puts a ton of time into thinking about our applications and what we ask of candidates and crafting what's hopefully a rewarding experience in going through the application. And so it can be frustrating, I think, for the committee when a applicant starts answering questions that we didn't ask, or assuming that we haven't collected enough information from the things that we're asking, and provides supplemental things that we haven't asked for, or tries to kind of cram in more than what we've asked for. We really have thought about this a lot, and we want to streamline the experience as much as possible for our applicants and not ask for all kinds of things that we don't actually need. So I think on some level, you just kind of have to have faith that we've designed a process that gives us what we're looking for. And by going through that process and kind of respecting it, we'll all get where we need to.
Okay. What would you have liked me to ask you?
Linda, you've done such a thorough job. I'm not sure anything.
Okay.
Anything I mean, pops out at me.
We don't have to force it either.
So, I'm going to assume you've streamlined this interview to get at what you really need. So
I try. I will ask you one last question then. I mean,
sure.
Obviously, you attended Yale. I guess graduated now 12 years ago, right?
Age me. 12.
I won't tell you when I graduated. What do you look back on most fondly from your time at Yale School of Management?
Yeah. So there's so much, and it's so hard to choose, which is absolutely what has brought me back to Yale again and again.
I'll be lenient. 1, 2, 3. It's okay.
It's funny. So as an admissions representative, I know it's never productive to talk about the people because every school has great people and the kind of the community. But I do feel as though I get a little bit more leeway when I speak about the school as an alum. And I have had the benefit of now being out for 12 years and kind of maintaining that network. And, it's such an incredible group of peers and role models and people who I have now had as colleagues and I expect to have as lifelong friends. And so I think it's just rewarding to look back on those precious 2 years that I got to spend with them in the classroom, outside of the classroom, because that's really what formed the foundation of it. It's great to get access to any alumni network, but the time that you spend, in those 2 years forging those friendships and learning about one another in all of those different contexts is really, really quite irreplaceable. And I think all the things that make Yale, Yale made that even more special. So I think the fact that this is a super global place means that is a global network of of peers that I have now. The fact that this is a place that encourages people to think in a very interdisciplinary way meant that that network of people that I built came from a lot of different backgrounds, went into a lot of different things thereafter. So I think all the things that we continue to value in the school, I may not have appreciated it in those terms at the time, but as I look back, were absolutely essential in creating that lifelong network that I have today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Laurel. I really want to thank you for joining me today and sharing all this information and insight. It's been great.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Where can listeners and potential applicants learn more about Yale SOM's MBA program?
Yeah, so the most straightforward starting point for that is just som.yale.edu on the web. We, of course, welcome people to come visit us on campus, and you can find more information about doing that there. Specific admissions questions can go to mba.admissions@yale.edu, and we'd be happy to talk with you more through that channel as well.
Sounds good. Thank you. We'll include links in the show notes at exhibit.com/273 to the sites that Laurel just mentioned, as well as to related articles and show notes. Check them all out. They are all linked to from exhibit.com/273. And a quick reminder from our sponsor, 5 Fatal Flaws to Avoid in Your MBA Essays. You can download this your free copy at exhibit.com/273download. Listener, thank you too for joining Laurel Grodman and me for our 273rd episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with admissions directors, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.